The following interview was recorded for CFRO The Pulse, Vancouver Co-op Radio's daily news show. The Pulse airs Monday to Friday at 7 a.m. on 100.5 FM and streaming live at cooperadio.org.
Many people were shocked after hearing about an incident last September 20th at the Strathcona Park, Tent City, when a 25-year-old Vancouver man was stabbed and left to die, bleeding for over 12 hours. His injuries were so severe from not being reported earlier that he had to have one of his legs amputated. Now his mother is speaking out, asking why the Vancouver Police Department didn't provide more help when he was forced out of his home and made homeless, and also why it took so long to find his body and bring him into hospital. He's now on the mend, but a warning that many contents and details of this interview are sensitive and graphic and could be triggering. Well, it's an honor to have you with us, Connie.
Yeah, right on.
This is very distressing. Tell us about Carl, because we covered his case at the time. He was found at the Tent City here in Vancouver, stabbed and left for many hours bleeding.
Yeah. I tried to put a missing person report on Carl, and I couldn't get anywhere with that. They wouldn't take me serious.
Very, very upsetting to everyone in the city, in the downtown east side, and in that Tent City as well.
Yeah, for sure. It was pretty traumatizing for me also, and my boy.
I bet. I'm so sorry.
ICU was really bad. It was really heartbreaking to watch him in there.
Let's go back to the beginning, Connie, if you don't mind. First of all, what happened? Take us back to how he ended up at Tent City and why he was stabbed. What happened down there?
Well, my son got into he had an apartment of his own, and he got his own apartment by himself. And then a few months down the road, his girlfriend had moved in. Now they added her to his lease, and then they got into an argument, and the cops told Carl to leave and never to come back. So Carl left. And he was told never to go back there because there was a no contact order. So that's how he ended up in Tent City. So now I'm frustrated with the Vancouver PD right now.
And so he was in Tent City, and tell us about one week and one night, I guess he got attacked by people. What do you know about that incident?
So far, just what he says, like he was partying. And he just remembers being in somebody's tent, and then that was all he remembers. When the ambulance found him, he was unresponsive even. So he must have went into shock or something.
How long was he left there?
He was left there for, has to been more than 12 hours because they amputated his leg because he was laying on it, and it killed his whole leg. So it must have been like, for over the 12 hours, and somebody finally phoned 911.
Wow. How old is Carl?
Carl was 24 when it happened. He just turned 25, and in December.
And tell us a bit about him. Like, what does he do in his life? What's he like?
Carl's a really good person. He's good-hearted like me. Like, he'd probably help anybody. He would never hurt anybody like that. I know that he's a very kind-hearted person, and he would help anybody if they needed help. He was always giving people smokes and just a good person all around. He's funny. He jokes around today, you know, like he plays with his scooter and he tends to bang into people and he's a jokester. He likes to have fun.
So now he's mobile in a scooter now, I guess?
Yeah, he's mobile in his wheelchair now.
How does this affect you as a mother? This must be the most terrifying news to get.
Well, when I first found out, like, I didn't understand what happened at first. Nobody could explain to me what happened to my son. The nurse just said that he got into a big fight in Tent City. And that's all she could say until the cops came to see me at my hotel. And then they actually told me the extent of, like, what really happened. And I was pretty much in shock and heartbroken. And, yeah, it was the most heartbreaking thing. Now I'm traveling back from Kamloops to Vancouver every couple weeks. I'm down staying with my mother-in-law and my boyfriend, my fiancé. And it's just pretty tough because I got things going on in Kamloops and I got to bounce appointments back and forth. But yeah, we're doing it. I'm doing it.
When you found out that he was in ICU and, you know, you must have been so terrified, you know.
I was in Kamloops when I found out. I phoned the hospital myself to find out. And yeah, I was really terrified. I was like, I felt like I couldn't get to Vancouver fast enough. And and I didn't know what happened to him. No, the nurses couldn't explain to me what happened. So, yeah, it was pretty hectic time for me. I had to, you know, mother up and be there for my son because I thought he wasn't going to make it a few times in ICU due to the infection that he had.
I'm sure you breathed a huge sigh of relief when he did survive and got through this, despite having lost his leg.
Yeah, yeah. He's still here. Like, I'm cool that he survived and that, you know, I'm not embarrassed or ashamed to be with him when he lost his leg. I'm actually very happy that he's alive today. And I keep telling him that every day, like, I'm proud of you and you know, you're doing it, kid. Like, he's my hero now today.
Now, he wasn't charged or investigated in any way for the incident with his ex-partner? They just asked him to leave?
I'm not sure about that one, but I think they just pretty much put a no restraining order and told him never to come back.
Now, you're calling on the police to answer for what happened, especially with what appears to be perhaps a domestic dispute that they often have to respond to and need to protect people from harm without much information to go on. What do you think that they did wrong and what could they have done better to prevent this?
I think what they could have done better is to find out whose apartment it is first and before they tell people never to come back to their own place that was once that theirs. And they could have put, if the couple's fighting, put the girl in a abuse shelter and let the man stay at home, his home. And take people seriously. Like, if we're phoning 911 because our kid is hurt or missing, then don't take it as a joke because it's not. Because I was phoning 911 from Kamloops and they kept telling me to phone a non-emergency line. They kept hanging up on me. I had to phone for 3 days straight before they finally took it seriously that my son is, something's wrong. And that hurts a lot to be Aboriginal and to go through something like that.
It seems like that's a very common experience for Indigenous folks trying to get help from the police.
Yeah, that's what it seems like, you know, and right now we're getting blamed for the COVID thing too, right? Like, all the communities and Aboriginal communities have the COVID, so it just seems like Aboriginals is getting beat up one after the other, and it's pretty heartbreaking.
Are you surprised that he was allowed to bleed and get infected for 12 hours after such a brutal attack?
Yeah, I'm really surprised about that. Like, if I knew somebody was getting hurt in a tent, I would definitely stand up to these people. Because, you know, like, that is just not, it's inhumane to let something like that happen. And
or even not to call for help, you know, even secretly.
Or to be scared of these people.
I guess some people really build a sense of terror, that people are scared of crossing them or being called snitches or something.
Yeah, for sure, right? Like, what happened to my son is pretty traumatizing, and even to hear the story is pretty traumatizing. Because what happened to him, it's lucky he went into a state of shock or something that where he wasn't unresponsive, right?
Mm.
It's just amazing how a human mind can protect you from stuff like that.
For situations like this, for people, you know, pushed into homelessness in that way, what would you like to see changed?
Like to see the cops to help people, not just say, don't ever come back to your own place. I would like to see the cops to do more, like, to help the people that are in an argument and do more, be more caring or be more professional about it, and not just say, like, get out of your place and never come back. Try to help the people find a shelter to go to or a safe place where they could be. This is Canada. We're not in a third world country. That's what hurts the most, I think, like, and to take people seriously, man. knew something was wrong with my son because he didn't contact me. And I phoned 911, but I was determined to put the missing person report out on him.
What about safety issues at the tent city? I know that it's not the first incident. The previous version of that tent city had a brutal attack in Oppenheimer Park. What do you think is the cause of these kind of incidents?
I'm not sure. I think the cause is like people just keep letting it go and they're not turning these bad people in. And, you know, I think that the people that hurt my son still live in Penn City and people should not be scared of them. Like, yeah, just they need a safety net where like a group of people are together that they could go to talk to if something was wrong in Penn City. They need some kind of safety net, like the group that they have in Manitoba, the clan.
The Bear Clan.
Yeah, yeah.
And they do like patrols, helping people on the street, you know, connecting them to shelter services.
Yeah, so if somebody is hurt or somebody's getting hurt, that they could go to that person and say, hey, listen, somebody's in so-and-so's tent, they're getting hurt. Or whatever, and they could feel comfortable with saying, talking to the people.
Now, how is Carl doing himself? I know it must be very difficult adjusting to his new way of getting around.
Carl's doing, his spirit is really good. His spirit is really awesome.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, he has his down days, but he's going to start working with elders and finding his culture right and smudging and going to sweats and singing and drumming and stuff with the elders. And he's got a lot of support system, like a lot of support. A lot of people are reaching out and caring about his story and about how he's doing, about finding him housing, because that's the main thing right now is finding him housing.
And has to be accessible, obviously, for his scooter.
Yeah, yeah, and that's the hardest part, right? Like, we did find housing, but it was a town housing. It's not wheelchair accessible, so we have to trim it down.
What do you think it is that keeps him and yourself going day to day as he recovers?
What gives me strength is just watching him like smile and joke around and be happy, and it makes my day so much better just to see that smile on his face. And when he's having a down day, then I feel down, right? You know, but we're pretty close. I'm always phoning him every night, or he's coming over to visit me, and I'm visiting him at the hospital, and yeah, we're pretty close now today. So he knows that he could phone me and talk to me about anything, and that I'm not judging him or I'm not upset at him or whatever, right?
You mentioned your family is Indigenous. What nation are you connected to?
We're Cree. That's mm-hmm. where the Sinclair name comes from, Manitoba.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners hearing this and maybe who have experienced a similar incident? We're based in the downtown east side, so I know this is not news to everyone, but obviously a horrifying incident that shocked a lot of our community.
Yeah, for sure. It shocked. It did shock. It was a hard thing to go through and live through today. And I just wish for Tent City to get housing. I wish, you know, the story gets heard and people that live in Tent City to get the proper housing, the proper care, and the proper, like, mental health issues. And, you know, like, cops are out here shooting us, for Christ's sake. And it's scary because we have mental health issues, right? Like, I know I do. I got a few mental health issues, and I wouldn't want a cop just coming up to me, shooting me on the street.
Well, I really thank you for your time, Connie, and I wish you the best for your family and for Carl's health as well.
Yeah, thank you so very much.
Thank you for talking to us today. Best wishes. And that was Connie Sinclair. She's Cree from Manitoba. She now lives in Kamloops, but comes to Vancouver to take care of her son in Vancouver, Carl, who's recovering from his injuries. This is The Pulse on CFRO 100.5 FM and Vancouver Cooperative Radio. For the rest of our show, we're going to hear from an important press conference from the provincial health officer, Dr. Bonnie Henry, who said that the province is at a precarious tipping point when it comes to COVID-19, and the numbers are not improving as we had hoped.
There are now a number of variants circulating worldwide that are proving to transmit more easily than the ones we've seen in the past. In particular, we're concerned about one that has been labeled the UK variant, but it is technically known as B.1.17, and we have had 5 cases of the B.1.17 variant detected here in British Columbia. All of them are either related to travel or related to close contact with a traveler, including the 3 initial cases. So far, we have had no ongoing transmission from any of the 5 identified UK cases. In addition, we've also had 3 cases arise through our surveillance of the B1351 variant, and this is the one that has been linked with increased transmissibility in South Africa. All 3 of these cases were community acquired, so they were not linked to travel, which is, of course, something we are concerned about. They weren't linked to each other, and we're now investigating. 2 were in Vancouver Coastal, 1 in the Fraser Health Region, and public health is doing backward contact tracing, trying to determine where they may have acquired their infections. These are, of course, concerning, because we know that if we start to see rapid transmission, that we could be in a position where we're having way more transmission in our communities than what we're having now. We have been following using whole genome sequencing through the BC CDC from the very, very beginning, and we've sequenced about 11,000 samples so far. And we continue to monitor in areas where we are seeing ongoing transmission, where we're seeing rapid transmission, and where we're seeing transmission in, for example, younger people, to determine if these variants could be associated with disease here in British Columbia. So far, we have not seen widespread transmission, but it remains a concern and something we'll be watching carefully. But we also need to know that the things that we do to prevent transmission of COVID works for these variants as well. There are several things that I need to speak to you about this today. First and most important is to make a very specific request of everybody in British Columbia. In the last couple of weeks, we have plateaued at about 500 new cases of COVID-19 a day. This is too many. This leaves us at a precipice, at a brink, where we can see rapid takeoff, particularly if we start to see any of these new variants starting to transmit in our community. This shows us that while we're getting a handle on long-term care, the virus continues to circulate in our communities. And our immunization is working in these high-risk settings, but we are still at risk. We're at the threshold of where we were in late October, November, when cases started rapidly escalating. And we need and know how to stop this. We can either go up, and where we've seen that happen in other provinces, in other countries, all around us, we will have more people severely ill. When we have lots of people infected, even young people become severely ill, end up in hospital. We will have more of our family, our community, who are hospitalized, who need ICU care, and who will die from this virus. We will have more of our healthcare workers under strain, and more restrictions will be needed to slow things down in our community. Or we can have less. We are now into the second incubation period from our winter break. Less is where we need to go, and I need your help to get there. Over the next 2 weeks, I believe we can bend our curve, not just plateau, but bend it back down. And this is at a time that's critical, where we have very limited vaccine, and we need to target it where it will do the most good. The public health restrictions in our province are dependent on what we all do now. My ask of you is to take a step back and remember that COVID-19 is still that unwelcome guest in our homes, in our workplaces, in our communities. I'm asking you now, as much as possible, more than you've ever done before, to stay home, to stop those social interactions, to focus on the key things that are keeping us together, focusing on our work from home if we can, focusing on making sure children can go to school, focusing on making sure our healthcare system can continue to function. This is the most challenging of times for us. It's not the time to falter, despite us being tired and frustrated and wanting it to be over. We need to hang in there. We are so close, but we need to do this now. We need also to remember to find joy every day, to find those things that get us through this. We've been in this for a year now. We know there are things that we can do to support each other. We know how important it is to go outside every day to get a little bit of fresh air and perspective, to make sure that we find that moment where we can listen to music, where we can look at art, where we can find theater online, those things that give us that joy in life, to make sure we hug each other, that we take care of our family that we're close to in our households, and that we reach out virtually and care for those who are around us in our community. Right now, we can't rely on the vaccine to protect us all, yet. It's our individual efforts now more than ever that will have the impact that we need right now in these next 2 weeks, so that we can get back to having those social interactions we all want and need.
Question today is from Zara Premji, CBC.
Hi there. So Dr. Henry, what is your reaction to the BC couple who went to the Yukon and lied to get vaccinated? And since they are from BC, we're also wondering what that means for them getting their second dose. So what is the policy for the second dose for anyone who goes out of BC to get a first dose?
Well, I think they should be ashamed of themselves. They put a community at risk for their own benefit, and that to me is appalling. In terms of people who are immunized somewhere else and are in BC, if they're residents of BC, then the second dose may be here, in the same way that if we have people who are in British Columbia for their first dose and live in the Yukon or Alberta and get their second dose there. So that is something, you know, the immunization is free for Canadians across, for everybody in Canada, not just Canadians, across the country. So one of our tenets of being in Canada is that we can interchange these. But, you know, I think I am very, I'm very saddened and disappointed that people would do that. But I'm also heartened to know that the vast majority of people in Canada and in BC do not think that way, and know that the approach that we have to protect those who are most vulnerable is one that they support, and I thank everybody in BC for that.
And that was Dr. Bonnie Henry, the provincial health officer of BC, speaking at a press conference. But a reminder from harm reduction experts: never to use drugs alone. Try to find Insight or the overdose prevention site or another safe consumption facility, or use with a safe buddy.
CFRO The Pulse is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, a program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.